Hey, what's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is Monday, December 11th, 2017. And this is a Rock and Roll Monday. How are you guys? Thanks for tuning in. Fresh back from Sacramento all weekend. Nice to be up in NorCal. Getting a little wake-up call about their chilly night weather. Forgot all about that. Awesome. 5 sold-out shows with Joey Diaz at the Punchline. What a magic weekend. Thank you, everybody who came out. And if you are a new listener and just found out about me at those shows, welcome. Welcome, my friends. It's me doing Michael Devin impersonating David Coverdale. Well, anyway, I hope you guys are good. Great weekend, man. Great weekend. And it looks like those are the last road weekends for me for the year. And probably pretty happy not to be at the airports during the holidays. Nothing worse than traveling, around the holiday time. The airport was a ghost town yesterday. It's so amazing when an airplane or airport's a ghost town and the plane's kind of empty. You're just like, oh, this is what life would be if there were more earthquakes and natural disasters. As funny as cruel as that sounds, it is true. The planet is just combusting, man. God, it's just... My hat's off, man, and love. Send some love out to these people that have lost from the fires this week and last week, from Ventura County all the way down to San Diego, man. It's just horrible. California is just on fire. It's just crazy. First Santa Rosa, Napa, and all that, and now SoCal in December. And still people deny global warming. Anyway, we don't need to get into that those politics on there, because then it'll just be like, yeah, you're... It's the holiday time. Let's put it all down to rest and enjoy it. Thanks for everybody who gave me some love on the 8-year anniversary, the emails and tweets. Were incredible. Thank you so much. It has been an incredible 8 years of ups and downs and fun. Mostly, I'd say 99.9% fun. And I couldn't do it without you guys. I want to give a shout out to some people that donated this week on Patreon. If you want to donate, it's Dean Del Rey. Yeah, just go to Patreon and type in Dean Del Rey, or go patreon.com/Dean Del Rey, and it'll come up. Joe Sabo, thank you so much, buddy. And Spencer Wozniak. Shit, man, I know I'm fucking that name up. And it was a good donation. I'm all fucking your name up. Anyway, thank you guys for donating to the podcast. And... super cool, man. Super cool. Happy birthday out to Nikki Six today and my photographer guest from a few months ago and friend Steve Rose. And speaking of photographers, I have got a guest for you today, man. And I can't tell you how much I just love interviewing these photographers, man, especially the old school dudes that have been doing it all their life. My guest today is Jay Blakesburg. And if you don't know who he is, just press pause right now and go to his website or his Instagram and just lose your mind at this guy's photography skills. It's unbelievable. He's been shooting since he was 16 years old. He has some of the greatest Grateful Dead photos of all time. But not only is he like a jam band photographer and a dead, you know, kind of the dead scene photographer, but early on, he shot a lot of stuff at the I-Beam, where I spent a lot of time just losing my mind over some of the most insane concerts ever. I-Beam on Haight Street was ground zero for the alternative rock scene, as I used to call it, the Live 105 scene. Live 105 was an alternative radio station in San Francisco. And as I talked to Jay and I talked to Larry last week from Primus, and anytime I talk to somebody from the Bay Area, it really blows my mind what a mecca that place was for incredible music. Jay's got a great story, man. He's done some time for selling acid, which is a really interesting story. He also took the iconic photo of Bono when Bono painted that rock sculpture on the Free concert down in Justin Herman Plaza. That is one of the most infamous and famous U2 concerts ever. And that was really a big break for Jay. And it was great to have Jay on, man. He has definitely got a great energy. And I believe that that comes from doing what you love to do all your life and being around incredible music. Me being the buffoon that I was early on in life, not liking the Grateful Dead, probably one of the only regrets in my life. I don't really have any regrets. And this really isn't one, but I wish that I would have been into the Dead earlier on. But I'd probably be a different person, that's for sure. And who knows, for better or worse. But Jay's been there forever, and he's shot some of the best Grateful Dead photos. And it was great to have him on. It was pretty fucking exciting, actually. He's got a brand new book out, and he has many books out. We share the love of Mother Hips, which he has a Mother Hips book out, which I never even knew. He also has a great Primus book out. He's got a bunch of killer books, and the guy is fucking the real deal. So it was an honor to have him on today. You're gonna enjoy this one. I would consider this a handmade episode because all his photos are done, you know, basically he makes them. He points the camera, shoots it right at the right time, learned all about, you know, settings of the camera early on as a kid, and that you know, that is a skill. A million people could shoot a rock concert. There's probably about a handful that shot photos that blow your mind. And that's why you keep seeing those same rock photos over and over, because they're that iconic, just as iconic as the band they're shooting, you know? Let's see. I want to give a shout out right here to Carson Hess, my new guitar sponsor. You're looking for a custom-built guitar, you need to hit up my man Carson. Have you seen my Blackguard Esquire? It is unbelievable. Anyway, hit him up, man. Go to his website, hessspd.com. Check out this guy's next level guitar skills, man. Christmas is here. Get yourself a handmade, don't go buy one off the rack, man. Get one with soul. Get one that has some sweat and, you know, just handmade features and whatever you want. Neck shapes, colors, you know, weights, all that stuff. Pickups, you get to pick it all. Check out Carson Hess. Go to his Instagram, Carson Hess 81. Or his Twitter, but mostly check his website out because they're all on there. He's got a great portfolio. And also, maybe you want to get a guitar restored or you have a guitar that you might want to have relict, whatever, hit him up. I love this guy. Great sponsor. And also, the fantastic El Cajon Harley, my motorcycle sponsor. How amazing is El Cajon Harley? Yes, super amazing. They got great, great deals going on right now. Hit him up. Talk to my boy, Greg Riley. They got all kinds of Christmas goodies going on. Also, we're going to be doing a El Cajon Harley night at the fucking La Jolla Comedy Store. My brain's a little cooked right now. That's going to be great. That'll be in January. Find out more about that. Ride your bike and get in free on a Sunday in January at the La Jolla Comedy Store. Thank you, El Cajon Harley, for sponsoring the podcast now for almost 2 years. That is pretty fucking badass. You got to get your bike serviced or maybe a helmet or some boots or whatever. Hit up El Cajon Harley. Check out their website, elcajonharley.com. They are Southern California's king Harley-Davidson dealer. Fly in from wherever you're at and get yourself a bike. I really want that CVO Road Glide in the Battleship Gray. Speaking of Battleship Gray, I just got back from the auto show yesterday, and Kevin Christie and I will be talking all about it on Thursday's episode of Bitchin'. I will run down some of my favorite cars at the auto show. Porsche absolutely murdering it this year with the Porsche 911 GT3 Touring. Oh my God. And also the Porsche 911 T. Incredible. Incredible cars I saw yesterday, and I'll talk all about it on Thursday. Before I do get into the episode, I want to tell you something. I was in Sacramento hanging with my boy Jeff Fletcher, Fletchy. And he took me to a secret record store, keeping it secret right now, because, man, did they have some gold, and I want to mine it. But I finally got, I've been looking for this record forever. It's out there all the time, but it's never super clean and mint. And I found a clean, clean one, Gary Newman's The Pleasure Principle. And some of you are probably like, what? Gary Newman? You mean Randy Newman? No, Gary Newman. Had a hit back in the day. Here in my car, I go driving along. But that's not what it's about. Gary Newman is right up there with me with Kraftwerk and Devo. You know, a lot of people are like, hey, man, I like hair metal. You got to branch out, man. There's music out there that blows my mind. Some of that stuff back in the day, man, Gary Newman, Kraftwerk, Devo, that stuff is just incredible. You want to know where Nine Inch Nails got their sound or any of that industrial stuff, let's say, you know, of course, Marilyn Manson, who else? Ministry, all that early industrial stuff, you know, it all comes from the ground zero of like Gary Newman, and Kraftwerk and some of that early Devo, man. It's just incredible. Gary Newman has a new record out right now that blows my mind so much. I can't even believe how good it is. He's 59 years old, and I believe he's out on tour right now. I've got to see him. I always say, look, I'm not going to go see the bands I've seen 5-10 times anymore, unless it's like the Mother Hips or something, or the Dead. But I've got to still see stuff that I haven't seen yet before these guys go. And Gary Newman has a brand new record out, and it is just incredible. And I highly recommend you get it. It's called Gary Newman Savage, Songs from a Broken World. Savages, as my good man Joey Diaz would say, savages. Anyway, this record came out this year. There's a song on here called My Name is Ruin. It is fucking fire. So yeah, I scored a beautiful piece of vinyl over the weekend, and I plan to go back to the store and get a lot more stuff. The guy that worked there was a total dick. Walked in, you know, Fletch and I are laughing, having fun. No one in the record store. He's on the phone. He's like, guys, keep it down. Keep it down, guys. I'm on the phone. I go, you got a bathroom? No. And then as I didn't even want to give him any of my money, I was like, fuck this guy. But he had records I wanted. I was like, fuck, you know? So as I bought a record from him, as I was leaving, he's like, sorry, guys, earlier, I was trying to get some health care, you know, which I could see health care is going to, you know, make you crazy. It's absolutely one of the nuttiest things in America right now, the whole health care issue. But hey, dude, we're going to spend money, so don't be a dick. All right, let's get into it, man. I hope you guys had a great weekend. I love all you guys. I will be at the Comedy Store this week, and also I will be at the Ice House in Pasadena on Friday, 10 o'clock. A lot of great shows this week. A lot of great guests coming up on the podcast. I love you guys. If you're in the Bay Area, go to the Hipness shows, the Hips Christmas shows this weekend. That's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 2 at the Music Hall, and Sunday is at Slim's. I got to tell you guys, let's keep the candles lit. Here he is, Jay Blakesburg. Are you a vinyl guy?
Not a vinyl guy. I have a lot of vinyl. I just don't have anything to play now, but a cheap record player.
Oh,
are we going here?
Yeah, we're going.
This is it.
This is how we do it. Professional style.
All right. We're ready to roll, man. Yeah, my kid's got like a close and play that we bought him. It's really funny. When I gave him his record player and he wanted to skip forward a song on this Pink Floyd record I got him.
Yeah.
He said, "How do you skip forward to a song?" He didn't know you had to pick up the needle and move it.
Hilarious.
He was like in seventh or eighth grade or something.
How old is he now?
24.
24.
He lives in New York City.
Oh, yeah?
He's working on, he's a PA on films. He's working on the new Scorsese film that he's
Netflix.
Yeah.
They were filming while I was walking by. It's the one with De Niro and Harvey Keitel. Uh-huh. And De Niro's playing Hoffa.
Yeah, my son's probably was the guy that probably held you back for traffic. He's like, you know, PA on a walkie-talkie. All right, hold traffic.
Right.
All right, come on back through. It takes over.
Yeah, yeah.
He's working on a show called Bull, which is a CBS show.
Bull?
Uh-huh. And then he just worked on The Americans. You ever watch The Americans?
Oh, yeah, that's a hot show.
That's a great show. So he had to turn Harlem into Mexico City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's my son. My daughter lives in Brooklyn at the moment. She goes to school up at Skidmore, which is in Saratoga Springs, New York, but she did a semester abroad in Brooklyn this year.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So she's been in Brooklyn
She's been going wild.
Yeah, she's
Which part of Brooklyn?
She's in Bushwick, I think.
Oh, yeah, Bushwick.
So she's been hanging in Brooklyn, but she's getting ready to head back up to Skidmore, and then she'll graduate in May and move back down to the city. She can't wait.
It's funny because The Dead just played there, and I think there's three places you need to see The Dead. Well, The Dead's gone now, but let's just say Dead and Cobra. One being San Fran, one being Boulder or Red Rocks, and the other being New York. Because it seems like such a... like New York is such a dead town also.
It always has been. Yeah.
Right.
And I've seen them do the Dead & Co., the new incarnation, which is fabulous.
Yep.
These guys are killing it. Mayor's killing it. The guys are killing it.
Yeah.
I saw them at the Garden last year when they played. I've seen them in Boulder this last summer. I saw the two big stadium shows in Boulder.
I was there.
And I've seen, San Fran, and I didn't go. I
was at the Levi for the Fare Thee Well.
Yeah, I mean, I saw them at Shoreline, and I mean, it was at Levi. Yeah, Fare Thee Well. I was the official photographer for Fare Thee Well.
Yeah, let's get into that, because it's pretty crazy to think. I mean, I first hear about you, of course. I was in New York and a guest on a podcast, and I ended up interviewing you just for a few minutes, about 10 minutes. And then I ran down the rabbit hole and I was like, oh, amazing, this guy's photos. And, you were the I-beam photographer in San Francisco, and that was like my stomping ground.
Yeah,
like,
so the I-beam, for people that don't know or remember, it was a nightclub on Haight Street in San Francisco in the 80s, and it was a gay men's dance club every night of the week, except for Monday nights when they had live music.
Is that what it was originally?
Yeah, it was almost always. And they only had live music one night a week, Monday nights, not even on weekends.
Wow.
And I
didn't even remember that. I just always remembered it as a live venue.
Well, the only reason that I knew that is because, you know, I was the house photographer, and the owner had asked the booking agent, this woman named Kathy Cohn, who I knew. Kathy worked at Warner Brothers in San Francisco. And so Kathy... he said, "Hey, we need a photographer," and he wanted me to like photograph like this gay dance scene, and you know, I have nothing against any situation like that, but that's not my scene.
Right.
And I was taking pictures of guys that I thought were attractive and looked like they were having fun and whatever. And he was like, this is wrong. This is not the vibe. These are not the right people. And I'm like, but they're like good looking guys. You know, like I'm sure he had,
he wanted to be more edgy.
I don't know what he was looking for.
Right.
I remember shooting some guys that were like very young and clean cut and whatever.
Yeah. Like Cruising, the Al Pacino.
But maybe he wanted the Bears or something.
Right.
I don't really know. But anyway, I failed. Yeah. I failed at shooting the gay disco for him. But but the I-Beam, you know, like I saw Jane's Addiction there. I
mean, yeah.
What was the I-Beam?
Soundgarden.
Maybe like a 400-person club.
Yeah.
I mean, Jane's Addiction in 89, and, yep. You know, original band with Eric on bass.
Yeah,
and,
Eric Avery.
That was badass.
And Soundgarden on the Louder Than Love tour.
Uh-huh. Saw Soundgarden there. Butthole Surfers, Pixies, Throwing Muses, Firehose with Mike Watt.
Firehose.
That was fucking badass.
Amazing.
So, yeah. And like I said, it was like Monday nights only live music. And so I used to drive in. I lived in Oakland. I'd drive in, shoot a show, and I'd come back and into Oakland. I remember my girlfriend, who's now my wife, she would say to me, God, you just smell like cigarette smoke.
You know? Yeah, back then.
Back then, right? It was disgusting. And so I would take like underarm deodorant and rub it in my hair to go to sleep because my hair smelled so bad, like tobacco. Like,
I used to hang my clothes in the garage.
Right? Disgusting. I mean, I guess we're lucky now that we don't have to deal with that. So.
Yeah. Now,
but the I-Beam was incredible, and it was just like, for me, it was, you know, it was the birth of alternative rock. And
it really was.
I mean, Soundgarden and Soundman was my college roommate, and he grew up with Kim and Hero, the original bass player, and that's how I originally met Chris Cornell and those guys. I went to dinner with them. They played The Stone on Broadway.
They
opened for a band. They were the opening act in 89, I think. So I met Soundgarden, and then when they came back to the I-Beam, they had this guy, Eric Johnson, who was their merch guy. He later went on to become Pearl Jam's tour manager, and then Neil Young stole him away. He worked for Neil Young for 20 years.
Wow.
But I have a great picture of Eric Johnson at the I-Beam pulling Chris Cornell out of the audience after he stage dived off the stage and was like crowd surfing. You know?
I think I've got to be in these photos.
We're going to go back and look at the photo sheets.
Yeah, because what happened was I drank a bottle of Jaeger. You know,
you were a hot mess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I came up. I remember I fired my bass player right when I got there because he, you know, he was one of those guys that couldn't go anywhere without his girlfriend. And at the time, I was like, we're going out as a band, like the idiot, you know, the lunacy of that.
Did you have a girlfriend back then at that time?
No. So,
okay. I was just wondering what her name, because I met this guy. I'm wondering if it was you. I have this picture of this guy raging in a leather jacket, but maybe it's not you.
I was definitely wearing a leather jacket, though. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, but. And you know, I drink it and then I just start hitting the stage, man, and diving, and they grab me and they throw me down those back long stairs. I rolled all the way down.
Did you know Buck Naked?
Oh yeah. Buck Naked. Right. Yeah. Remember his brother, was
the drummer in the band.
Yeah. And he worked at the, Paradise Forever.
Right. The bartender.
He was the bartender.
Right. And you know, so I have pictures. So Buck was for that Soundgarden show, he was the front of stage security throwing you off the stage.
Yeah, you don't even remember.
But so Buck Naked, he was this like kind of legendary guy in San Francisco. He performed with a plunger over his penis.
Yeah.
And his brother was the drummer, and they were Buck Naked and the Bare Bottom Boys. It was a three-piece kind of cowpunk band. And he was a bartender also, maybe at the Paradise. And he came home one night, he lived in the Hate, came home one night, 3 a.m, and walked his dog in the panhandle. And the bird man, the pigeon guy, shot him and killed him.
Shot him because he said the dog was trying to kill his birds.
Yeah. And so Buck Naked. So I did the last photos of Buck, you know, like the publicity photos. I shot his album.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like this legendary San Francisco guy. It was a very sad fucking story, man.
I can't believe that I don't even know you, you know what I mean? Because I've like, you and I have been in the same exact fucking circles the whole time.
Well, see, you were a punk rocker, but
no, I was more like metal.
You were a metal punk dude, but you were also, you had that hippie vibe inside you, even though you didn't like those hippies because you grew up in San Francisco. You deep down, I mean, look at you, man, with your fucking mohawk and your tattoos, and you're wearing a Grateful Dead shirt right now.
Juxtapose,
right?
I'm fighting myself.
You're like one of those scary deadheads that people would look at and be like, ooh, don't talk to him, he's dangerous.
Well, I found the dead. Backwards, because not backwards. I mean, the dead was always right in my face.
Well, when did you do acid for the first time?
Back in the 80s. But that's not what it was about for me. I get into the Mother Hips, and I'm like, oh, I'm loving the Mother Hips. And then, of course, I'm a huge Black Crowes fan, and I'm playing music, and then I'm at the Horde tour, and I'm seeing all these bands, and that whole jam thing's exploding with Blues Traveler, and I was a huge Allman Brothers fan.
Wow, really?
Huge.
God.
But I never liked the Dead.
See, it's funny, because when I was shooting at the I-Beam, right, like, I would be shooting the Butthole Surfers, and I couldn't tell the person standing next to me that next week I was going to shoot three Dead shows or the Allman Brothers, because because those are my roots, yeah. Right? Hippie music, you know, Southern rock, the Allman Brothers, Marshall Tucker,
fucking
Charlie Daniels,
that shit.
You know, but the Grateful Dead, and that's what I grew up in. And like, they were two very different worlds back then. Like, you couldn't, it was oil and vinegar, man.
Absolutely.
And nowadays, everybody's, their minds are much more wide open about the whole thing. But back then, like, you fucking could not go in and be like, hey, you know, Butthole Surfers today, Three Dead shows next week, Chili Peppers the next week. Like, that didn't jive back then.
It's but so I was, weird, right?
But I was a hippie photographer, but I was trying to figure out how to make a living as a photographer, and I was shooting the birth of alternative rock, you know, the Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction and Soundgarden. I shot Nirvana and Rough Trade Records on Hate Street before Dave Grohl joined the band.
Wow.
They were supposed to come to my studio afterwards south of Market, and they got lost and never found it and drove to Sacramento, and they called me like 3 hours later after waiting there for hours. Nobody had cell phones.
Yeah.
They're like, we couldn't find the alley, and we just left, and we had to go to Sacramento. Their booking agent was the same booking agent and manager as the Flaming Lips, a woman named Michelle, and she was a friend of mine, and she was in San Francisco, and she set it up for me to do this shoot with Nirvana, and then they just never made it to the studio. And I shot Nirvana on stage,
yeah, right,
but never did a portrait of the band.
It's crazy, man, to think about how, like, back then, like, I remember I loved Prince, but I didn't tell anyone, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I worshiped Sign of the Times and Purple Rain, and I loved Terrence Trent D'Arby and all this stuff, too, you
know?
Did
you go to the Purple Rain tour? I saw it at the Tacoma Dome, and I wore all purple, but I wore all purple every day anyway back then. You could see I got my purple kicks on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, I always wear purple, but so anyway, like, I went with this one other, you know, hippie dude from Olympia, Washington. I was at Evergreen State College in Olympia, a hippie college, and we were like, and the whole arena was just black people, you know, there was no white people in there, let alone fucking hippies like me. And but, you know, I saw the Purple Rain tour in 84.
It's like when I saw Public Enemy on the Fear of the Black Planet tour at the Shoreline. I was like the only white guy there. People were coming up to me like, hey, where's the bathroom? And they thought I worked there. You know what I mean?
You're out of place.
It was hilarious, but man, I'm so glad I saw that shit, you know?
Yeah, I think I only saw Public Enemy once opening up for U2 maybe at the big stadium show or something like that.
Now what?
But I did shoot a little bit of hip hop for a while there. Like, for some reason, at some point,
like Too Short and stuff.
No, the art director at the Source magazine decided that me, Jay Blakesburg, white suburban Jewish hippie, should be the next hip hop guy. And so I shot a cover of the Source with Snoop.
Wow.
Did one with Dre.
Wow.
I did one with E40, which is how I met E40. I went on to shoot a couple of albums for E40. You know who E40 is, right?
Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, of course.
Popping your collar, popping the collar.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But so
what about Digital Underground or that?
Just like in passing, but never like a photo shoot with them, never Tupac. But so here are a couple stories. So Snoop, I get hired to shoot him for the cover of The Source, fly down to LA, rent a studio. And he pulls in. We open up the studio garage door, metal rolling door. He drives in with the Escalade, and he's 4 hours late because hip hop guys don't know any concept of time.
Yeah.
Right. He opens up the door, and the whole fucking cars filled with smoke. It was like classic Snoop. And so back then we're shooting film and we're shooting on a Hasselblad, which is a medium format camera, right? There's 12 shots on a roll and then you have to change the film back and put a new on. And we're reloading some film and I turn around and Snoop's in the chair that I'm shooting him on. And he's passed out.
Oh,
right. And I go over to Snoop and I'm like shaking his shoulder. I'm like, dude, Snoop, wake up. And he like all groggy. He's like, yo, man. Sorry, I'm known for passing out at my photo shoots. Right? Classic. But then Dre was even better, right?
Yeah.
So I fly down to LA and Dre had just left Death Row Records, right?
Yeah.
The whole Suge Knight thing and Suge's got a hit out on him, right?
Yeah.
The whole thing. And so I'm at the studio and I'm waiting there all day and Dre, no concept of time, never shows up. Publicist calls like after waiting there for like 5 or 6 hours and says, Dre was in the studio all last night. He's not coming. Can you do it tomorrow? I'm like, sure. But I got to fly up to San Francisco tonight because I'm going to shoot Primus at the Civic tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
So I fly back up to San Francisco. And thank God I did, because the band and the crew had the best backstage nitrous party you've ever been at.
Yeah.
Like, I have pictures of the whole thing, like black and white, like 40 people in this big giant dressing room. Everybody's got balloons and it's classic, right? Fly back down to LA the next day. And we have a Hollywood prop electric chair because, you know, that was the logo for Death Row Records.
Right.
And it was like a shot. It'd be a shot of like Dre with the electric chair behind him, or maybe he's looking at it like, you know, it's in the past.
Like, see you later.
Right. And so he gets to the studio and he's got like 15 bodyguards on him. Right. And they're like, no one's allowed in the studio. Suge's got a hit out on Dre. Right. And we're like, okay, you know, and these guys all are packing.
Yeah.
you know, three Escalades or whatever pulling up behind Dre's limo. And so they come in and they look at all the wardrobe, and we've got like 40 outfits for him to choose from: black sweatpants, white sweatpants, t-shirts, button down shirts, anything you could possibly imagine that he could possibly want. And he looked, and he, of course, he was 3 hours late for the next shoot the next day. And he looks and he goes, I don't like anything here. I'm going to jump in the car and go to Melrose and go shopping. Gets in the limo with the three Escalades following him and his 15 guys, and comes back 3 hours later with a black pair of sweatpants and black t-shirt. And that's what we shoot him in. We had like nine versions of that.
Oh, man.
So, but that was the cover of The Source, you know. And wow. It was great. And that was my shoot. So I did a few things for The Source. And then that art director left The Source and went on to, I think, Esquire or something. And I stopped doing work for The Source, you know.
You shot a lot of stuff for BAM magazine, too.
Yeah, so BAM magazine is Bay Area Music Magazine. It was a newsprint magazine, came out every 2 weeks.
It was massive.
Yeah, and there was an LA version and a San Francisco version.
Right.
And sometimes they did the same cover, but then they had different inside editorial. You know, the LA version was geared towards down here. And in 89, I walked into the offices and I said, hey, guys, here's my portfolio. And I had like a handful of tear sheets. I had been published in Rolling Stone magazine a couple of times and a couple other magazines. And I think I had maybe one or two magazine covers that were just like live shots, not portraits. And I said, I want to shoot portraits and I want to shoot covers for you. And they were like, ha, ha, ha. And a few months later, they called me and they said, we have your first cover. Can you go shoot Camper Van Beethoven in Santa Cruz?
Wow.
And that was my first magazine cover for BAM. And I went on to shoot, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to say it's somewhere around 60 covers for BAM.
Wow. What was the biggest band you shot for them?
Well, it's not necessarily I shot Metallica for them.
Ooh, wow.
But I would say maybe the biggest, the most exciting, that wasn't even for BAM, it was for LA Weekly, but it ended up on a BAM cover, was Tom Waits. Was incredible.
Awesome.
Did a couple portraits of Tom Waits.
What's that, like Bone Machine era?
Bone Machine, oh yeah. So, I shot Waits for the cover of the LA Weekly during Bone Machine, right?
My favorite.
I go up to Cattati, right?
Yeah.
Which is Prairie Sun Recording Studio.
Yeah, Mooka.
Right, which is an old like chicken farm.
Yeah,
right?
Mooka's
and
place.
It's like an active, there's chickens running around everywhere, chicken wire, right?
Yeah, and the studios are actually built into the old chicken coops, you know?
Yeah, and so when Waits gets there to record the Bone Machine record, they start showing them all these beautiful plush recording rooms, tracking rooms, and, you know, beautiful, brand new, remodeled. And then he goes, well, what's this room? What's this room?
Yeah.
And they open it up and it's the storage closet where all like the cleaning supplies are. And it's got 20-foot ceilings and it's concrete floor and bare walls. And he goes, this will be the room that I record Bone Machine in. And that's where I did the photo shoot.
Oh my God, such a great. Oh, is that the one with the chickens around him?
No, it's the one with the piano. He's sitting at the little,
little
tiny piano,
yeah.
The black and white shot.
Oh yeah.
And I've got a show up in San Francisco if you're around. It's up till January 5th. It's at the Harvey Milk Photo Center, 50 Scott Street. It's a career retrospective. And right. I got that Tom Waits photo blown up 3 feet by 3 feet. And
man.
All printed on aluminum. It's amazing. But so that was one of the shoots. I shot Ice-T for, and Neil Young covers, Todd Rundgren, Bob Weir, Les Claypool, Rob Wasserman.
Just all the greats.
The list goes on and on.
Yeah.
Jane's Addiction was one of my, when they were doing the first year of Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
So we drive up to Sacramento and they're doing a show in Sacdome. We're supposed to do an interview with Perry in the hotel that night. And they're like, well, you can't really take any pictures. And he's in there with his girlfriend at the time, which was that woman, Casey Nicolai, who maybe is his wife. And she was the one who directed the Been Caught Stealing video.
Right.
And he wanted to show us this video. They were cutting a live Jane's Addiction video, VHS to VHS is how they were cutting it.
Wow, okay. Really?
Yeah, this is a
nice. That's how they're editing?
Yeah, they were doing like a rough cut, VHS to VHS, that whole editing suite in their hotel room. And he's talking to Steve Stolder, the BAM editor, writer, and doing the interview. And Casey's like passing out in the photo shoot because they're fucking.
They're doped up.
They're all doped up.
Yeah.
And I do a portrait of the two of them and then him alone with the editing stuff behind him. And then the next day I go and shoot the band and the band's imploding, right?
Because
they were imploding before Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
And Eric Avery was just like, he was just like not into it. And Navarro's eating a chocolate chip cookie. And I've shot Navarro many times since and he's great. But, you know, they were all just. It was bad. You know what was going on, right?
Yeah.
It was just before Lollapalooza took off and Navarro's eating a cookie. I go, hey, can you put the cookie down? He goes, fuck you, dude. He goes, this is my time. You know,
wow.
I'm doing like a band portrait of them. And he's like, and then he like hides the cookie behind his back.
Oh, fuck.
And then it was like a very almost famous kind of moment. Because instead of putting the band on the cover, they just put Perry on the cover.
Yeah, okay? The total fuck you.
Right? And so, of course, it was just like this. I'm sure the band was fucking, I don't know, but I can't imagine they were anything but pissed, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, I would have been. I had great portraits of these guys, you know, like incredible, would have been an incredible cover.
Yeah.
I shot the Chili Peppers in 89 when Flea and those guys looked like little babies. Frusciante was just in the band and shot him the Fillmore portrait upstairs. So yeah, a lot of BAM covers, and that sort of got me going. And you know,
now let's get into it a little bit. You grew up in Jersey, right? And how do you get into rock photography? What were you doing before that? Like, were you like, you did you stumble into it or what?
Pretty
happened?
Much, yeah. So you know, in the late 70s, I start carrying a camera with me and start bringing
Pentax.
Borrowed my dad's Pentax camera.
I had a Pentax. I hadn't heard that name. I looked it up and I was like, man, I haven't heard that brand in a long. Are they still around?
I think they are.
Really?
I don't know 100% though. I'm not
sure.
They
were the shit for a while. Yeah. And it was like Rossignol skis and a Pentax camera.
Yeah. And so my dad loaned me his camera and I would take pictures of my friends in high school. It was sort of like, you know, high school's awkward.
Yeah.
You know, like you're trying to be with the cool kids, but you're trying to fit in and you're taking pictures of everybody and printing them in the dark room and showing social media, man.
Yeah. And
hey, look at this 8x10 glossy, man.
And you're into music.
And I'm into high school? I mean, we were fucking sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, it was the 1970s. We had no future, right? I mean, you know, we would
Jimmy Carter.
We would snort anything that, you know, somebody said, hey, this is crystal THC, you know. Wow, THC, that's in marijuana. That sounds good. Snort, you know.
Yeah. Snorted anything.
It's some fucking chemical that some fucking biker made in Rahway next to the prison, right?
Yeah. You don't even question it. Isn't it crazy?
No.
I always say, like, I didn't die back then, but I'm sure I'll get something, you know, like, what's this on my neck. Oh, right. That's some crystal.
I mean,
from
we did so much shit that, like, it's shocking that we're still alive.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, stupid behavior, not even just drugs, but, you know, driving in cars with drunk people.
Totally.
And so we were, you know, smoking a lot of weed and we were, you know, we started dropping acid in 78, I'm guessing. Yeah, 78. We started, you know, snow days, you know, that would snow. They'd cancel school. Your parents would go to work. We got some blotter acid. We'd stare at fucking Grateful Dead album covers all day and be like, whoa, dude, it's fucking melting, you know?
Yeah, you were a dead guy back then.
Right. And you know, you have older brothers and sisters that turn you on to certain music. My older brother was into Zeppelin. My older sister was into the Allman Brothers and the Dead.
Right.
You know? And so, And so, you know, I go to a Dead show in March of 1980 at the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey.
First one.
No. Oh. At this point, I've been like, you know, truly psychedelicized. And this guy walks up to me, he goes, hey, you want a dose? And I'm like, sure. And he takes out a sheet of acid and it's not perforated and tears it in half and gives it to me. And it's got a bunch of little triangles silk screened on it. And I go, well, what's one hit? He goes, he's triangle. And he gave me 50 hits.
Whoa.
So I start like tearing them up and handing them to all my friends.
Yeah.
We're all fucking tripping. And that's the night John Belushi comes out and does a cartwheel on stage and plays US blues with the band. Right.
Whoa.
And so we're all fucking tripping. And then the guy says to me, he goes, hey, he goes, if you want, I'll mail you a couple thousand hits of acid and you can sell them to your friends back in New Jersey that you went to high school
with. Just a random dude you meet?
It's just like some guy we met on tour, right?
Just like
at the concert. His name is BT, Brother Tom. He lived in San Francisco on the Panhandle.
Right.
Right? And he goes, and if you want, you can become part of my underground LSD network.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow, that sounds like a great idea. Here's my address.
Yeah.
So he starts FedExing me thousands of hits of LSD. And, you know, it's a free market economy. You know, you get 100 hits for $50. You send them to sell them to your friends for 100 and they sell them at $3 a hit, you know?
Right.
And so he's sending me a couple thousand hits of LSD every couple of weeks and I'm selling it to my friends. And, you know, we have a good thing and we're making piles of cash and going on Dead tour. And one day, you know, I go to FedEx in New Jersey to pick up a package with a couple thousand hits of LSD, and the cops in San Francisco were watching BT in California.
Yeah.
And they notified the local authorities, and they came at me and grabbed me and threw me against the car and said, you're under arrest.
Wow.
And so...
Busted for acid.
Busted for possession of LSD with intent to distribute. I was, I think, 19.
Whoa.
It was 81, April of 81. And the wheels of justice turned slow, but eventually I lost all my appeals and I was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in state prison.
5 years. Now we talked about this. They weigh the paper. This is how they give you your time, right?
This was just before they started weighing the paper. I got lucky.
Yeah.
And I got lucky because the 5-year sentence was also what they called an indeterminate sentence. And then the parole board determines what your time goal is based on your crime and your previous record. I had no previous record.
Right.
And so based on my crime, possession of a controlled dangerous substance with intent to distribute, I got a time goal of 12 months, which was the least I could get. And I could work off 3 months for good behavior.
Wow.
And I ended up getting out in 8 months. I had a friend whose father had done some political work with the president of the parole board for the state of New Jersey.
So you go to prison?
I went to state prison, dude.
Wow.
I'm a fucking hardened criminal. You scared of me? Tattoo mohawk boy.
Where'd you go? Upstate?
I'll fuck you up.
Where'd you go? Upstate?
In Jersey. No. I was in Jersey. I went to a prison called Annandale, the Youth Correctional Institute at Annandale.
Wow.
Which was supposed to be for kids that were like 18 to 21, but because of the overcrowding in the prison system, they had people there that were in their 30s and 40s, but it was still a minimum security prison. I mean, you do go to maximum security for a minute because they want to, first you're in county jail until they figure out where they're going to send you.
Right.
And then you go to this place called Yardville down in South Jersey, which is like a big major, full security, prison, and then they give you all these psychological tests. They want to determine if you're going to murder women, children, and babies when you get out of jail.
Wow.
So do you need to go to Rahway State Prison with the lifers, or do you go to Sunny Camp Annandale where they sent me?
Yeah.
And so I remember the psych test they gave me, and they said, draw a picture of your house and your family. And you only have a pencil. So I draw a house, and I put all these flowers and clouds, and then I draw like the arc of a rainbow.
Yeah.
And then in the each color, I write red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. You know, like I have no colors.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're just like, this guy is a pussy. He's going as minimum security because he's drawing rainbows and flowers.
Excellent test.
And so I'm a
hit. He didn't draw any guns.
Right.
And,
no.
And liquor, like a stick figure with a bottle of Jack Daniels. Right,
exactly. This is my father.
Yeah. A whip.
And so then, you know, because I'm a drug offense, I have to be in the drug rehab program. Right.
Right.
So we're all sitting around in drug rehab. And the guy next to me, he's like, yeah, you know, I stole my family's heirloom jewelry. It was worth a couple $100,000 and sold it for $2,000 worth of dope. And the next guy, yeah, I'm addicted to Quaaludes and Coke and speedballs. And the next guy, and they get to me like, hi, my name is Jay, and I'm addicted to LSD.
Yeah. Were you addicted to LSD?
How can you be?
I know, right?
You can't. So, you know, it was just like, it was comedy. I always said, listen, I kept journals of it all. I always said, if I ever were to write a story or try and do something, which I have written, I wrote a whole, like, screenplay treatment that I tried to sell to Hollywood, and nobody was interested in my story. Go figure. But I always said it would be a sitcom, because it really was comedy. There's so much comedy in jail.
Oh, fuck.
You know, and listen, I don't recommend anybody going, and I'm like the straightest dude ever out there, even though I'm a hippie with long hair. Like, I haven't smoked pot in 35 years.
Because of the bus?
No, I just, you know, well, I stopped smoking pot because of the bus, right? But, you know, once you stop, like, you know, the pot these days is so strong.
Oh, it's brutal.
You know, like, so I haven't smoked pot since 1981.
Yeah.
I haven't done drugs since 1981. I don't drink alcohol. I don't drink coffee. Like, you know, like I'm the straightest.
Yeah, I don't either.
I'm like the straightest dude out there. But this was part of my life 40 years ago almost, you know, 37, 38 years ago.
I think fascinating
experience, let me tell you.
I think back to that Festival Express thing, you know, that movie with the dead and the band. Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
And it really looked to me like in that movie when the deadheads are kicking down the fence and sneaking in, you know, and Jerry was disgusted. You know, he's like, I don't know if these fucking assholes think we do this for free or whatever, but they can fuck off, you know. Do you think that because it was a big turn off to me was, now that I look back at the dead, was the crowd. Like, I was more into booze and coke and all that, but that hippie kind of, all right, far out acid thing is what drove me away from the dead. And
bad move, dude.
Yeah, no. I look back at it now too. Right. Yeah,
like look at all your buddies that were like, you know, the metalheads and the punks from back in the day that get up now in the morning and eat a Pop Tart and a cigarette for breakfast.
Yeah,
you know, versus the hippies who wanted to eat organic brown rice back then and take acid. You know. Like,
yeah.
Look at where people are today, right?
Well, I mean, you know how it is, though. You know how you want to rebel on what's,
right. No,
what's
I
jammed
know.
Up your
Listen,
ass.
Listen, you know, when I was, you know, post-prison, when I started following the Grateful Dead again, and again, I was like, you know, chasing a career as a photographer, totally straight and sober, but I saw a lot of fucking people addicted to dope, to heroin, a lot of deadheads.
Right.
Garcia was a fucking heroin addict.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw there was a lot of the dark side, which is funny, you know, because I'm known for a lot of my pictures of deadheads dancing and deadheads on Dead Tour and and that whole thing. And, you know, a number of years ago, the advent of Facebook, you know, 2008, I joined Facebook and I posted a whole bunch of photos of deadheads. And it started this whole new conversation. There was actually an article written in the Huffington Post about how my photos on social media sort of brought this group of people back together that hadn't really seen each other since Jerry had died 15, 20 years earlier. And a lot of people say, God, you know, I saw you on tour, but I ran away from you and your camera because I thought you were a narc.
Right.
I didn't know who you were.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we were doing shit that we didn't want anybody to see. Like, we were selling drugs and we were doing dope and we were, you know, and people didn't do stuff like that out in the open the way that people walk down the street smoking a joint today. Right,
right.
And so, you know, it was interesting to hear that perspective. And a lot of people are like, I'm just not in any of your photos because I made a conscious effort. Do you know who Owsley Stanley III is? Owsley was the guy who made 6 million hits of LSD in the Hate in the 60s.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He built the Wall of Sound for the Dead. He was the sound guy.
Yeah, I know who he is.
So Owsley used to run away from photographers backstage at dead shows. And I remember being backstage in a New Year's run one time in Oakland and saw Owsley. And he was sort of like the holy grail of photos to get for me. Because I was like, I was always chasing the people that were sort of the elders of the psychedelic movement. I've done portraits of Leary and Kesey and the Grateful Dead and the psychedelic poster artists from San Francisco and a lot of people that were important to the modern day psychedelic movement, right? And so I wanted a picture of Owsley, and I remember like picking up my camera and seeing him like turn around and bolt, like he knew, right? And so in 99, I was up at the Grateful Dead office. This is post Jerry Garcia, and Phil Lesh and friends were rehearsing, and I had a whole photo studio set up, and Owsley lived in Australia, but he was visiting Phil and doing some sound and some recording, and he walks by this photo studio I have set up because I'm doing a portrait of Phil and the band he's rehearsing with. And he goes, what's this? And I go, it's a photo studio. He goes, you want to do a portrait of me? And I'm like, uh-huh. Yeah. And he sits down and I shot 12 frames in black and white and 6 in color with my Hasselblad. So, you know, 12 frames on a roll of film, square portraits. And I'm the only person to have ever done a portrait of Owsley.
Wow. You know,
in his entire life. And it was so rare that I did it, that when his wife saw it, like, she didn't believe. She's like, how did you get this picture? He didn't let people photograph him. Like, what, you think I chained him to a chair and, like, made him and do it? But it's just, you know, that's the way people were, because back then people were afraid of photographers.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, they just didn't know how to respond to us because, you know, don't you remember in the electric Kool-Aid acid test in the book, they said, you know, the way you can tell the narcs was the shiny black FBI shoes.
Right.
You know, they were shine and they had the laces. Like, those were the guys. So you'd go into the Grateful Dead parking lot and there'd be some guy wearing a tie-dye.
Yeah.
Right?
But he'd still have his shoes on.
He had
on
the shiny black FBI shoes and you knew to run, you know. But, you know, I had an unfortunate thing. They were, like I said, they were watching BT in San Francisco and, you know, and I got caught and I went to prison and I got out and I went straight. I got rehabilitated.
Yeah.
Look at me now.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is now I grab onto the hippie scene more than ever. And especially in this political climate and everything, it's just really like when I go to a dead show, I'm like, oh, right. And really what it comes down to is still to me to this day is the music. You know, it's always about the music for me. And I, you know, so when I'm there, I'm like, oh, this is like, it's like that Bumblebee on the Blind Melon video. You open the gate and you're like, we're here, you know?
You know, the other thing, like you said, is about the music. But if you really, really think about it deep down, the punks and the hippies were the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. You know, none of us wanted to work. None of us wanted a straight, normal 9-to-5, 2.3 children, 2-car garage lifestyle.
Suburbs.
Right. We all had the same things. You know, the hippies and the punks, you know, were anarchists, you know, anti-authoritarian, question authority, question what our parents did. You know, we just had long hair and the punks had short mohawks or short hair. You know what I mean?
Right.
We, you know, really, they're the same fucking people. Right. But they listen to different music.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But we really do have the same ultimate goal, right? You know, we just happen to eat better food.
Yeah. I eat clean as a motherfucker.
Right. Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. Because you're 50 something years old and you want to
be 51. I want to live.
You want to live. You don't want to be, you don't want to, you know.
Yeah. I think Jerry died at 51, right? Or 53.
Yeah. Jerry, you know.
And we're, like when you
looked like he was 25 years older than you are right now.
Unbelievable, right? Yeah. But it's funny because if you look at a picture of me like 3 years ago, I look like Jerry. I'm giant. You know what I mean? My face is.
Yeah.
All,
no, I know. Yeah. And I walked in here today. I was like, man, you lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
You look like an old man. And some of your pictures on the internet.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Now, you had to have landed like your dream job because you go to jail, you get out, but all of a sudden you start shooting the dead. How does this come about?
Well, so, all right. So
I know the infamous story. You shot some photos and then you got one like signed or whatever. And then
well, that was just a fan thing. I had taken some pictures when I was a teenager and I was at a dead show and I, you know, handed a 8x10 glossy to Bob Weir's girlfriend in 1979 and had Jerry signed. I'm gonna dig those up and post them online.
I saw that one great photo though I sent you yesterday. It's like your second show you shot of him.
Yeah. That was in 78. I was 16 years old when I took that photograph. So what happened was, is after I got out of prison, I moved to the Olympia, Washington, when I went to college, Evergreen State College. And I did that for a few years. And then I moved to the Bay Area with a girlfriend who wanted to go to school down there. And I did my last year of college sort of as an internship, getting involved in media. And I started actually just being an usher at concerts. Remember the ushers at all the Bill Graham shows?
Yeah. Hand out the little pamphlets or whatever.
Yeah, and seat people, whatever. Yeah. And then I just started taking photos and I would bring my camera to any event that I could, any free concert. The radio stations all did free concerts. I mean, I saw Radiohead for free in downtown San Francisco in 95, right? So the radio stations did free concerts outdoors. And there were all these events and there were a couple of interesting things that happened. So one of them was I had a friend who went to high school with the photo editor at Rolling Stone magazine. So by the time I got to the Bay Area in 85, by 86 and 87, I was starting to shoot at the I-Beam and I was building a little bit of a body of work and I was showing that to people. You know, you shoot pictures of things and you show those photos to people, hire people that shoot those kinds of things. In my case, it was musicians. And so I was just slowly building up a little portfolio for better or worse, mostly worse. You know, if I look back at a lot of that stuff, it was probably pretty shitty.
Right.
But I was trying to figure out, you know, like we didn't have digital cameras where you take a picture, look at the back and say, ooh, too light, too dark.
You actually
had to have the technical skills and ability to actually expose film. And you had to have a creative eye as well.
Yeah, you got
to
fuck with the ASA, all that stuff, figure it out.
And so I started showing my work and getting little rinky-dink assignments and a $100 gig here, a $200 gig there. I lived in a house in Oakland with six roommates, paid $150 a month rent, lived on rice and beans. And I was sending photos to Rolling Stone magazine. And Jody Peckman, the photo editor there, liked what I was shooting, but she said, because I've never worked with you, I'm not allowed to work with you. It was like this weird catch-22.
Well,
you're sending
weird.
Us exactly what we need, and we use what you shoot, but I can't use you because I've never used you before. Right? And that just kind of came down from the higher-ups above her. And so then one day, 30 years ago, 3 weeks ago, on November 11th, 1987, U2 played a free concert in downtown San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, the famous one where he paints the
Justin Herman Plaza.
Yeah, he paints the thing. One of the most famous concerts ever.
Right, and we had all heard rumors that this was going to happen because they used the Grateful Dead sound system.
Oh.
Okay? Bill Graham used the ultrasound sound system.
Right.
And so I heard about it. We knew it was coming, and then they announced it on the radio on KFOG. Remember KFOG radio?
Hell yeah.
They announced it on KFOG, and I put my cameras on my back, and I was walking out the door, and the phone rang. And it was Jody Peckman from Rolling Stone. She said, Jay, I have your big break. I need you to shoot U2 in downtown San Francisco for me.
Wow.
And that was my first assignment for Rolling Stone magazine. And since then, I've done over 300 assignments for the magazine.
Did you get the famous photo where he's climbed up there and painted?
That's my shot.
That's your shot.
That's my shot, dude.
That fucking photo has like been around the world.
Yeah. And so so from that moment on, and then I started getting like immediately Jody flew me to LA to shoot Roseanne Cash at the Roxy. And then she had me shoot a benefit in Oakland with Carlos Santana, Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, and Boz Scaggs. And so all of a sudden, I'm shooting all these things for Rolling Stone. So then all the local publicists and people started thinking of me as the Rolling Stone photographer, even though I was a freelancer.
Right.
Like I was just this guy shooting for whoever wanted to pay me $250 to go shoot something.
You're like a Mark Seliger but on the West Coast.
But Mark was always a portrait shooter and not a live shooter.
Yeah.
I started out as a live shooter.
Right.
And then what happened was I realized that if I wanted to actually make a living doing this, I couldn't make a living doing $100 and $200 photo shoots that were live concert stuff, I needed to learn how to do portraiture. So I went and bought a Hasselblad out of the newspaper classified sections off a SFPD guy for $1,000. Borrowed some money, bought some lighting, studio lighting, and taught myself how to do portraits.
Wow.
And then I, like I said, I went into BAM and told him I wanted to shoot covers. And then all of a sudden I started doing portraits. And so my body of work is portraits with studio lighting, big productions and available light portraits and album packages and live stuff. But slowly it just kept building and building. So it was, you know, the Rolling Stone thing and then the BAM magazine thing. And then I started shooting covers for Guitar Player magazine. And then I started showing my work to record companies in LA. Started getting gigs doing, you know, record company jobs. And it's just, you know, one thing led to the next. And so literally by, you know, the early mid 90s, 92, 93, 94, it had exploded for me. Right. You know, at that point I was already had shot Jane's Addiction and Nirvana and Soundgarden and all these bands and was shooting feature stories and shooting magazine covers. And, you know, it just kept going and going all through the 90s. And then by the mid to late 90s, Michael Goldberg, who was a Rolling Stone magazine editor, staff writer, started the very first online music magazine called Addicted to Noise. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. ATN.
And I started shooting for Addicted to Noise.
Wow.
And then we started bringing people to my studio, and I shot all these great features and all this stuff. And even though, like, and Michael was paying me pennies, you know, and I wish in hindsight that he gave me stock in the company, but nobody knew what that meant back then.
Right.
Because, you know, he eventually got bought out by MTV and walked away with 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 million, who knows?
Wow.
Some big number.
Right.
But if he had shared some of that stock, it wouldn't have changed his value, and we would have all made, you know, maybe a little bit of money, but none of us, there was a bunch of writers and editors and me that really should have been part of it, but we didn't know.
Right.
But still, you know, even though I was getting paid pennies to shoot this stuff, like it made sense because I was building this archive and I was building this library of images that has, you know, so much value in terms of, you know, pop culture history, right? You know,
absolutely.
And these photos get used in books and magazines and documentaries, you know, like one of my shots from Dre from that cover shoot was in the new Defiant Ones documentary.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that's pretty much how it all snowballed. And during all of it, I was shooting the Grateful Dead, but I was also shooting all this other stuff because I knew that I couldn't just be a Grateful Dead photographer. Nobody gave a shit about the Grateful Dead in the late 80s.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
You know, none of the big magazines cared about Rolling
Stone. Yeah, they're
the
not putting
Dead.
Them in mags and no. stuff. No. Now, when you're out on the dead, like, you've had, like, the incredible access to them. Like, even now, like, you're just on stage shooting. You know, like, I saw you at Hollywood Bowl, you know. Your access is amazing. Back then, did you have the same access?
No. You earn it.
Oh, yeah?
You earn that.
How's that go down?
Nobody gives it to you. The other thing is that nowadays also, you know,
it's the press. Well, 3 photos, you're out of there.
Well, the other thing is that the whole thing has changed now with social media. So every band wants photographers, and they have people that they work with and they like, and hopefully they trust. And that's really comes down to trust, right?
Absolutely.
So you earn that trust. But I still say to this day that me being on stage, no matter who the band is, the biggest band in the world or the smallest band in the world, it is a privilege, not a right.
Right.
And you have to earn that privilege every day, and you need to be respectful for the crew that's working around you and respectful for the musicians. But again, you know, sometimes I'm out there and I try and push the boundaries just a little bit because I want to get that unique photo.
Right.
You know, think about it. Like, you know, remember in the old days in the 80s and the 90s, you see all these video guys with their big video cameras and they were 3 feet away from the guy on stage.
Oh, yeah, it was terrible.
Right, but you do that with a photographer and everybody's like, well, you can't be on stage. I'm like, well, look at your fucking 4 video guys that are, you know, like, I'm going to get it in and out, you know? You know, so it's a weird thing, but there's maybe too many photographers now that have, you know, too much access.
Right.
You know, and a lot of them earned it and deserve it and should have it, but, you know, it's almost like, you know, I'm shooting for this website that, you know, my sister-in-law does that has 19, you know, viewers every month. And, you know, so I need to be backstage to get a snapshot of this band in the dressing room, you know.
Like, yeah, that's jive.
Like, you know, get the fuck out of
that
here.
That shit is jive, yeah.
Right,
that.
So it's a tricky thing, but...
How about when people show up for the photo shoots and they got their iPhone? You're like, get the fuck out of here, for real. You know, you just wanted to get in, you know?
Yeah, I was talking to one of my buddies who is in this new Grateful Dead book, right?
Uh-huh.
A guy named Jeffrey Mayer. And known Jeffrey forever. He's got he shot a lot of rock and roll in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And he does a lot of red carpet stuff. He's an LA guy. Hopefully he'll be at the book signing that we're doing in LA tonight, which I know this podcast will come out afterwards. But anyway, he was telling me that, you know, they used to give all these slots to people to be on the red carpet. You know, there's all these people behind the stanchion, right? And then there's a handful of people that are on the red carpet because they have better access because of whatever they've earned that access, right? Who they're shooting for, whatever. And he's like, and nowadays they, you know, that used to be maybe 10 people and now it's 5 and the other 5 people have iPhones.
Oh.
And it's like Google and Facebook and whatever. And they're there with their iPhones and Snapchat. And
that's terrible.
It's just, you know, I mean, they are can be good cameras and can take good pictures, but it's just, it's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad.
It is sad.
You know, we live in a world of mediocrity because of it.
I mean, when I look at your photos, like, I mean, you know, especially the Red Rock stuff, you know, it is fucking incredible. You know, I'm addicted to rock photography and I've had all kinds of great guys on here, but there's something about an incredible rock photo that just stops me in my tracks forever.
Thank you.
All the great guys, you know, and I
appreciate that. Yeah. That's what I try and do with my photography every day. It doesn't always work.
Like those ones you shot of the guitars, the you know,
Jerry's guitars.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, like Baron Wolman was also a wise guy. Like everybody was shooting Zeppelin and he had the wise thought of shooting Jimmy's guitars right there, right before they went on. There are 6 guitars in the stands. And that kind of stuff to me is so magical because you're like, okay, that's the instrument away from the guy.
Right. That's the that's the thing that created the magical musical moment.
That's the tools, right. Yeah. Those are the crescent wrenches.
You know, it's funny because back in the day when we shot film, we didn't think about, oh, get a close-up of the guitar. Like nowadays, you know, it's digital. Like, yeah, close-up of the fingers, close-up of the guitar.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it's a different mentality. And,
yeah.
And it's good. I'm okay with it. I like it.
Do you remember once you start getting some pretty good access, are you actually hanging with Jerry, talking to him or anything?
No. I mean, with Garcia, you know, the 3 or 4 times that I was one-on-one with him was all business. You know, I was there to do a portrait or a shoot or whatever. Right. One of my favorite shoots was I was shooting him and David Grisman for the cover of Acoustic Guitar Magazine. We're doing this in David Grisman's living room in Mill Valley. And the best way to get musicians to just let you keep shooting and sort of is to let them ignore you and just play music.
Yeah.
So Garcia and Grisman. So first of all, Garcia forgets a guitar, right? Doesn't even have his guitar. And it's for the cover of a guitar magazine. So Grisman gives him a guitar that he's never played before.
Yeah.
That's just not his character. But that's what I have, these photos of this old Gibson. And Grisman's got his mandolin. And they just start playing music. And then they start singing. And I'm trying to shoot a magazine cover. I'm the only guy that's ever told Jerry Garcia to stop singing.
Oh my God.
I'm like, Jerry, don't sing. Just hum it in your head. Because I don't need your mouth to be all wonky when
I,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And so I told Garcia to stop fucking singing.
Yeah, oh, man.
But, yeah.
That's so awesome, man.
But no, I mean, it was all business. They were doing their thing. I was doing my thing. They had interviews to do. They had turkey sandwiches to eat and, you know, you move on. But nowadays, there's more time to hang. Like I do, you know, I try and hang out with Weir and socialize and Hart and Kreutzmann and Phil Lesh and those guys, you know, when I'm doing stuff with them.
Yeah.
And not just make it all about business and make it be a little bit more personable, you know?
It's I always feel for you because you're shooting hippie bands and their clothing is never really that cool. You know what I mean?
Not always.
Because I'm so into rock and roll clothes, right. Also, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you look at old Zeppelin, like Jimmy in the dragon pants and stuff, you're like, here's number 5,000 photo in the tie-dye.
Right. Or like, you know, in the summer when bands are playing festivals and they're wearing shorts and high socks and sneakers. And,
yeah, right.
You know, cargo shorts and a bad t-shirt. I'm like, oh, dude, come on.
John Mayer wears some pretty weird stuff out.
John Mayer is a fashion forward kind of guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's his own man. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny because when he first joined, I was like, I wonder what he's gonna wear. You know, that actually went through my mind.
Right.
You know?
My favorite outfit was when he wore that plaid shirt and plaid matching Bermuda shorts.
Yeah, what was that?
That was great.
Yeah, that was that.
And then there was a meme made of it where they showed a kid wearing almost the same thing with like a fake guitar, a toy guitar. And it was on the side of a milk carton and he was missing. And it's like missing so-and-so with a date found in Boston on the date that John Mayer wore those clothes. It's,
people are crazy. Like they find shit like that online,
People are clever.
Now, do you go out on the whole run with him?
No. So like the Dead tour that just happened, I just did 2 shows. I did Philly and Boston. And,
right.
You know, so I, you know, and that was a short winter tour. Like in the summer, last summer, I think I did 6 shows. The summer before, maybe I did four or six shows. So, you know, it just depends.
Yeah.
But anywhere from, you know, I'll be in Mexico with the band in February.
Oh, I wanted to go to that. It's sold out in 1 minute.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm going down for that. And I do a hour long slideshow storytelling presentation called Between the Dark and Light, the Grateful Dead Photography of Jay Blakesburg. And so I'm going to do that down in Mexico.
Oh, wow. Where do you do that? You bring it on the road?
I do bring it on the road.
Wow.
And I do I just did it in Boston and Philly. We did a killer crowd in Boston. We had about 250 people. Not one more person could have fit in that club. It was a little nightclub restaurant with some live music after. Packed the place, and that was fun. And I did it at the Ardmore in Philly, right outside of Philadelphia, at the Ardmore Music Hall, and probably had 200 people there.
Wow.
But yeah, so in Mexico, we're going to do it at each of the resorts over the 4 days.
That's dope.
Yeah. So yeah, one of these days I want you to come see it. You'll dig the storytelling thing.
I love that kind of stuff. You have a new book out now. When did it come out?
It came out end of October. It's called Eyes of the World, Grateful Dead Photography, 1965-1995. And I published the book, and I co-edited the book with a guy named Josh Barron. He was the editor of Relics magazine for about 10 years. And I have about 54 photos in it, I believe, out of the 220 that are in it. So there's actually 60 photographers in the book, and it's the Grateful Dead from the beginning of their career. We have the amazing Herb Green's, you know, early mid-1960s portraits of the band. We have all this Jim Marshall stuff in there, Baron Woolman, Peter Simon. We have two Annie Leibovitz photos in the book.
Wow.
And beautiful book, beautiful, beautiful. You can buy signed copies. I'll sign them from eyesoftheworldbook.com. If you want to check out some of my other books, like I said, I've done many other books. That's rockoutbooks.com is my website. And like I did a book, I don't know if you know about my Hippie Chick book.
No.
I did a book 2-3 years ago called Hippie Chick, A Tale of Love, Devotion, and Surrender. And it's all photographs of women over the last 30 years over the last 37 years.
Wow.
At music festivals, concerts, dead shows. And the book is about the connection between women and live music.
Wow.
And so the subtitle is, it's called Hippie Chick, A Tale of Love, Devotion, and Surrender. So love is how you fall in love with a band, an artist, a song, a lyric, a community, a scene, a hippie, a punk, whatever it is. Devotion is how you're devoted to that band. You see them numerous times on the same tour. You travel long distances. You collect their memorabilia. You collect their music, set lists, posters. And surrender is going to the show and surrendering to the moment.
Wow.
Forget about the kids. Forget about the carpool, the mortgage, the husband. They're
in
all,
it.
And being in the moment. And I love this book. And then we have about 80 quotes in there from women that are in photos and that we interviewed about that experience, what it means to them to connect to the music. And then there's three essays, a love, devotion, and a surrender essay that were written by this incredible woman who I met at a festival who just blew it out of the water. And Grace Slick from the Jefferson Airplane wrote the foreword,
the
original Hippie Chick. I used one photo in the book that's not mine. It's the foreword photo. It's a picture of Grace from 67 that Jim Marshall took.
Wow.
And it's one of my favorite books. It's called Hippie Chick, A Tale of Love, Devotion, Surrender. You can get it at rockoutbooks.com, order a signed copy from me, and find booksellers everywhere.
You were just showing me some incredible photos of some weed plants that you shot up in Oregon. Those are insane, man. Like I love looking at weed plants, like old, like High Times. I love that stuff. Like I always said, if I didn't do comedy, I'd probably grow weed because I don't really smoke it.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't smoke it either. And so what happened was is that an old friend of mine who I know from Dead Tour from 35 years ago, he's a grower in Southern Oregon, and a couple years ago, and then another friend of mine from college, who is now really good friends with the other guy. They didn't know each other before he moved down. He has a farm. And so they said, we really want you to come up and photograph our farms because these, you know, they've never been properly photographed and these are out of control. Like you said, I showed you these photos on my phone.
They're insane. They're like these monster plants.
They're 10 pounds a plant.
Like most plants I've seen, they grow straight up and it's grown different, like where it's just tight buds. And
they're 18 feet around.
It looks like an explosion.
And 15 to 20 feet high.
It looks like a nuclear explosion cloud, that kind of big old fucking jet. I've never seen anything
So 2 years ago, I flew up there and we did a bunch of photographs of their farms, and it was just an incredible experience. And then I just went up and did it again right before harvest this year. Because last time I went in the end of September, and they kept complaining, you're here too soon, you're here too soon. But my schedule was so busy, I couldn't go after.
Right.
You know, you need to be here in 2 weeks, and you know, all these buds are going to explode. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I mean, I thought the plants looked incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like taking pictures of like the classic marijuana leaf, you know, the symbol,
the belt buckle.
And they're like, laughing at me. They're like, why are you taking a picture of that? I'm like, because it just looks cool. It's a marijuana leaf. Like, no, take a picture of the bud that's like exploding here, these cones, you know? And so I went back up this year, and I went a couple weeks later, 2.5 weeks later, and they literally were waiting for me to shoot. And then like I'd shoot a plant and they were cutting them down right behind me.
That's incredible. Yeah. These plants look insane.
Insane, yeah. It's very cool. And the reason why we went up this year is because, you know, all the laws are changing because, you know, the man is getting involved. The tax man is getting involved, and the drug pharmaceutical companies are coming there. My buddy whose farm I shot said that he had these guys coming there and offer to buy his farm, offer to have him grow for them. They were from like Pfizer or something like that.
Wow.
And you know, he's like, I'm standing in the mud in my boots and they're in their loafers, their penny loafers. And,
wow.
And he's just like, dudes, get the fuck out of here.
They just want to jump in on that fucking pharmaceutical
money. So now, you know, you have to declare if you're growing medicinal or recreational. And if you're doing recreational, you have to have like 24 hours a day video surveillance, and you have to turn those tapes into the governing board, and there's barcodes and blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't even know. It's like out of control. And so, you know, to put in a security system like that or a video system could be $50,000.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and my buddy looks at me, goes, Jay, this fucking sucks. All I really want to do is just fucking grow pot.
Yeah.
Right. I just want to be left alone and just grow weed and make a living.
How'd they find the guy? Just because he's legit, so they just go.
How they find? You mean the authorities?
Yeah, the Pfizer guys. Like, how they find this?
Okay, so if you go to Southern Oregon, you just drive around.
Yeah.
in the valleys, and all you see are fences that are 10 or 15 feet high with black plastic or fabric around them, and you know those people are growing.
Whoa. No shit.
Yeah,
huh?
You just drive around, you just see these gardens everywhere. Some of them are 20 plants, some of them are 40.
I'd like to roll a drone through there just for footage, right?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. You'd probably get shot.
Yeah, the drone would.
Yeah.
Now you did like I think one of my favorite records and bands of all times is the Mother Hips, and you did the cover for Part Timer Goes Fool. I didn't even fucking know this till about 4 hours ago. And I'm like, holy shit. You did Part Timer Goes Fool.
Yeah.
And you are a massive Mother Hips fan like I am. And it's funny because, you know, everybody has that band they love that they think should be huge.
Right. And that's that band. And they deserve it. A, because they're incredible songwriters and incredible performers.
Yeah.
You know, like you look at, there's a million bands we can compare them to that are like playing arenas and big theaters.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that never happened with them. But these guys are one of the great American rock bands, without a doubt.
They're so incredible, right?
You know, they sort of coined the phrase California soul.
Yeah.
And that's what they are.
How do you find them?
In what way?
Like, how did you first find out about the Hips?
So they were being managed by
Billy Cohen
and Colleen Kennedy. And I was a rock photographer on the scene. And people wanted me to shoot their bands because they thought I was cool or something. I don't know. I thought I was a fucking little nerd.
Yeah.
And so when they finally got signed to American Recordings, Rick Rubin's label, they had some money. And Colleen said, we're going to hire Jay Blakesburg. And I got hired and we shot Part Timer Goes Fool in my studio. And that was my first shoot with them. I think I'd shot them live once before. And then they made their second American Recordings
shoot
record.
Out.
Yeah. And yep. I think that, and then I did the publicity shoot. They didn't use like a photo on the cover or anything.
Yeah,
like
it was like the Wild Wild West.
Yeah,
thing.
I did a publicity shoot with them. And the publicist was like, these guys need to loosen up. And she brought out like a big full bottle of Jack Daniels. And the band got fucking trashed. And we got to Golden Gate Park and we're at the band shell. And they're like lying on the ground. And they couldn't even get up because they were so drunk. You know, they were like lying and then laughing at me. And we had to like wait for like an hour for them to like sober up enough that they could actually stand. But the woman, you know, because they were partiers.
Yeah.
You know, not anymore. You know, they're all sober.
Yeah.
But yes, like you, I love and adore them as people. They're dear friends of mine. They have a new record they just finished recording that I've heard a couple of tracks on. It's phenomenal. It'll be out on Blue Rose Music, I think, in the winter or spring of 2018.
It's coming out in April.
Yeah. Oh my God.
How's it sound?
Well, the few songs I heard, I heard a Greg song and a Tim song, and they're amazing. And I think there was one other song.
And you just shot the cover?
I just shot photos. I don't know if it'll end up on the cover or what, but we just did the photos for the new record last week.
Awesome.
Just right before Thanksgiving. And it came out great. And Tim, the lead singer, lead guitarist, or co-lead guitarist, had a bad accident a couple years ago, and he's been hobbling around on a one-legged man for a while, but his leg is back in action, and they have big Christmas shows coming up, and I'm going to film them for them. And
are you going to shoot them?
I'm going to shoot like a multi-camera video shoot of them.
Wow.
Yep. And looking forward to, they're just incredible. I'm looking forward to like Tim and these guys getting back on the road in a big way and doing what they do. And I hope this record gets some traction because it really deserves to be heard.
It's great too that over the years they've got to play with dead guys, you know, like Bobby and
Mickey and Billy. Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's funny because they were always sort of lumped into that dead, but I never really saw the there was tinges of like the Americana version of the Grateful Dead, but they were never
They're more Birds.
The Mother Hips were never really a jam band, but I think the name of the record, I wonder if I'm blowing it by saying this, but I think the name of the record might be Chorus. That's what they were talking about at the photo shoot.
That's pretty good because a lot of jam bands don't have choruses. You know, and that'll let you know right away.
Right.
Hey, these are songs.
Yes, and they are songs. These guys are incredible. The Mother Hips.
What's your favorite Mother Hips record?
Well, I mean, I like a bunch of the earlier, you know, I like Later Days a lot. Yeah. I like Pacific Dust a lot.
That's a great one.
But Green Hills of Earth might be my favorite.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. Like that, for some reason, that whole record really resonated with me. It resonated with my kids when they were 10 years old. We did a great photo shoot for that record. That was the shoot where they wore all the white turtlenecks.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
The white pants. We went out in the middle of the intersection in the financial district.
Yeah, that was a bizarre look for them. Uh-huh. It was like, whoa, wow.
Yeah, that was a Jay and Tim idea, I believe. Or Jay and Greg and Tim, something like that. But we started talking about like ideas, and it came up, and I was like, you know. And they were like, maybe we should wear like, you know, white pants. I'm like, why don't you wear all white? And white, and Tim's like, when white sneakers? And then they went out and did it, and they came to the shoot and they had it all. So
that's great.
Which is funny because for this new record that we just shot, we did all black turtlenecks against a black background.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God, black turtlenecks.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
So yeah, the Mother Hips, Blue Rose Music. Blue Rose Music is a great new record. They're working with Jackie Green, who's really good friends with Tim and Greg and those guys from the Mother Hips, and they're working with Jason Crosby, who's the keyboard player in the Mother Hips when he can and plays with Jackie Green. And, you know, it's like a real Americana, blues, folk rock and roll scene in the Bay Area that Blue Rose Music has sort of tapped into. So,
and they got some good backing, right?
Yeah. So it's an indie label, but they're doing it right, and they're really supportive. And so they're, you know, they gave a, you know, they're paying to get a real record made like record companies do.
Yeah.
And promoting it. So check it out. Mother Hips, Jackie Green, Jason Crosby.
Yep.
These are all great records, great artists, all on Blue Rose Music.
You shoot Chris Robinson at all up there?
Chris is a dear friend of mine. I've done the last couple of album covers, and there was an EP that came out a year and a half ago called If You Went There, You Would Be Here. I forget what it's called, but
right.
And that's my shot on the cover. And that was just before they got a new bass player. So it's a shot of just the four of them, Chris, Neil, Adam, and Tony. And love the photo. But then, of course, they auditioned somebody like a month later, and then they needed a new shoot. So I did a shoot with them at a festival on the East Coast just to kind of hold them over. And then I did another shoot with them a year ago, pretty much last January, up in Marin and Stinson Beach. And got some really beautiful photos from that. And so those are all their new publicity photos. So, yeah. And you know, Chris lives in the Bay Area now.
Yeah, he's up there in Mill Valley.
I'm not sure.
Fairfax.
I don't think he's in Mill Valley. I can't remember what town he's in.
Yeah.
But I think he's in the process of moving or something like that.
But
staying in the Bay Area, staying in Marin. But no, he's family. All those guys are family in that band.
You did the Dead Set record? What did you do on that?
Dead Set?
Dead Set, the two records. Did you work on
the acoustic?
Yeah, and the other one, the electric, you know, dead set. And then,
you mean in the 80?
Yeah.
No, I did not.
Oh, I didn't?
I did shoot those shows at the Warfield where they recorded them, but no, I did not. My photos are not on those records.
Right. You got to see those guitars up. I saw Wolf on that traveling Bill Graham exhibit.
Oh, that was a great exhibit. Oh, you saw the Skirbel here?
Yeah.
It
actually stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah.
Like I turned the corner.
Oh, you mean Wolf did?
Yeah, I didn't expect it.
You've never held Wolf, have you?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, and you know what else really stopped me in the tracks was all those Day in the Green photos, yeah. Man, of like, you know, Metallica and Grateful Dead with the wall of sand.
So there's a big, big giant print in there of Bill Graham with Jerry Bob and John Fogerty.
Yeah.
Taking it in concert against AIDS at the Oakland Coliseum in 89. And I didn't take that photo. It was taken by the Bill Graham photographer, but I set that photo up and then he butted his way in and got the shot.
Oh, and then, bastard.
His is in the museum show, not mine.
Did you shoot any Day on the Greens?
Later day. I did the Metallica, Soundgarden, Queensryche
one. Oh, yeah, I went to that.
That was in 91, I guess.
You got some photos from that?
Uh-huh.
Rad. Yeah, man. And then any other Day on the Greens?
I did Pink Floyd, but that was also like in late
92 80s. Or something?
Yeah, maybe. It was like post Roger Waters. Right. And I did Rolling Stones Day on the Green in 89, I think.
Oh,
it was.
Yeah, with Pearl Jam opening?
I think I did that. Yeah, I shot that one.
Tim and I went to that. We went that together.
Wasn't that one at the ballpark in San Francisco? No.
No, that was at Oakland.
Okay, yeah.
Halloween, I think.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Halloween, yeah.
Yeah, Tim and I went.
Yep, you're absolutely right. I shot that. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't shoot any of the... I wasn't in the Bay Area in the 70s for the classic, you know, Leonard Skinner and Peter Frampton and Johnny Winter and Zeppelin and, you know, the Day on the Greens.
But, those are epic, man.
Yeah, but I did shoot...
I want to do a documentary on him.
On Day on the Greens?
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
I think it's like one of the, you know, it's the ground zero of really for America.
Of Stadium Rock.
Of Stadium Rock. And also...
Have you ever gone on YouTube and watched the Leonard Skinner Freebird?
From, of course. There's two. They
and
do
every,
two.
And everybody's sunburned. All the girls in their halter tops. They're like in the sun all day. Their skin is like red, like lobsters. You know?
I watched all those concerts back in the day when Bill Graham caught fire. Uh-huh. You know, they panicked.
His office, yeah.
Yeah, they panicked, and they transferred all that film over to my buddy, Mr. Pete, who used to do sound for the Mother Hips, and his job was to transfer them onto, like, VHS and stuff off the 8mm and 16mm, so he'd be like, come by Sunday, I'm doing Zeppelin, and I would go, and I watched all the shows. Yeah. I'd go by Sunday and just sit in there like a nerd, no one around. I'd be like, whoa!
I know, yeah.
And I don't know what they've done with all this.
It's all in Wolfgang's vault, unfortunately.
I know, but and they can't put it out because of the music sound. I don't know, but that shit is epic.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah, Bill documented a lot of what he did. And then that's Bill Graham we're talking about.
All the Winterland
legendary
stuff.
San Francisco concert promoter, impresario of the modern day live rock
the
and
king.
Roll experience.
The king.
Yeah.
They're finally doing a movie on him.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're doing it on Robert Greenfield's book. That's what I heard years ago.
I think so, yeah.
Right, nice.
Yeah, that's a good book.
So what else do you want to talk about before we wrap this up? Because I got to get out of here.
Yeah, we're out of here. Let's do it, man.
All right. So anyway, I'm Jay Blakesburg. I'm a photographer.
Are you going on the road doing book signings?
I don't have anything scheduled, but so I have nothing to pimp on your show about that. Like I said, you can buy the new Grateful Dead book at eyesoftheworldbook.com. You can check out my other books at rockoutbooks.com. You can find me on Instagram at Jay Blakesburg.
Great.
You can find me on Facebook at Jay Blakesburg Photography. I don't really, you know, my personal page, you have to have a Jay Blakesburg page to have a business page.
I know.
I don't post really anything on the Jay Blakesburg page. So just go to Jay Blakesburg Photography and hit like. And I post vintage archival shit all the time. And
it's so sick.
New stuff. And, you know, I tell stories when I can and whatnot. But yeah, the only thing I have coming up is at this Grateful Dead playing in the sand in Mexico in February. But I think I'm going to try and do like a, I want to try and do like a Florida, Atlanta, Asheville, North Carolina run in the Southeast in the spring.
Yeah.
And do like three or four of my presentations.
That'd be sick.
So, but I've done them around the country. I've done them on the West Coast. I've done them in New York and Connecticut and Virginia, Charlottesville and Roanoke and DC and Boston and Philly now.
I got to come see it.
It's I have a couple different ones. So I have one that's called Between the Dark and Light, the Grateful Dead photography of Jay Blakesburg, and one called Chasing the Light, the rock and roll photography of Jay Blakesburg, where I do all of my stuff.
Oh, wow. I think Primus and all that stuff.
Primus, I tell the whole Primus
story. I'm having them on tomorrow, the show.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Where?
Individually, like Larry first.
Right. I invited Larry to my show tonight. My opening. Hopefully he'll come.
Oh yeah, I'll text him.
Ask him if he's coming.
He's coming here tomorrow. And Bill Burr and I were just with those guys at Austin City Limits last month, and watched the set. Man, the new record is so fucking.
That's so great. Oh, I know. Yeah. Man, and they're good, dear friends of mine. I mean, I started working with them in '89. Did my first magazine cover of them in '90.
They're fucking incredible.
I did a book on the Primus called "To Defy the Laws of To Defy the Laws of Tradition." And it's a limited edition. You can find it on the rockoutbooks.com website. It comes in an 8x10 print, comes in a clamshell box. Les signed them all, and I signed them all, Les Claypool. So
I love
that. Was the second book that I did after my Grateful Dead book. And I did a book on the Flaming Lips. I did a book on the Mother Hips. You have the Mother Hips book, don't you?
No.
Dude.
What's that?
Where the fuck have you been?
I haven't seen that.
I'll send you one.
What are you talking about? For real? Is it like a photo book?
Yeah, it's a limited edition. They're signed by me and the band.
Oh, I got to see that.
Yeah. I'll get your address. I know where to find you.
Yeah. All right. I'll go to
here in Hollyweird.
I'm going to go to the show tonight. What time's your show in?
Tonight ends at 9, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m.
You should walk over and see me do comedy. It's a block away.
Okay.
Yeah, come to the comedy store and hang out.
From the Sunset Marquee?
Yeah.
Maybe I will.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what time do you go on?
Well, I'm on at 9, but you'll miss me. But what I'm saying is just come over and hang out. It's a wild scene. You will love it.
Can you put me on the guest list?
Absolutely. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. That's how we keep the show in the top 100. Also, you can get the show on SoundCloud or Stitcher. What is that? Stitcher, whatever they call that one, the third one. All right, guys. See you later.